want to make this session a little more a little more conversational, but I want to start it by telling a story. This is a story that is found in a very old Jewish text that was composed in Palestine. It's clearly Sufi, but it's found in a Jewish source. And my own teacher, Rabbi Zalman Schachter Shalomi, used to like to tell it. And his wife also tells it. And they both tell different versions. And now at this point, I find that my version is an amalgam of both and much bigger than both. I'm not sure how it got that way, but it is now. It's called The Source of Beauty. So once in some forgotten sultanate of the East, there was a group of young men who used to hang out in the souk, in the open market of this city. And these were young men who had not yet found their way, weren't quite sure they wanted to find a way. They just liked to hang out in the souk, you know, it's where everything was happening. It was an exciting place, it's where everybody comes to buy their goods, everybody, you can meet everybody from wherever they're living. It's the social center. And so they would hang out there, spend their days there. When they needed a little money, they would do a little work, you know, carrying bags for somebody, doing odd jobs. And they really just made enough money to buy alcohol with and gamble with at night. And that's how they spent their days and nights, just hanging out in the souk. So one afternoon, after a night of heavy partying, they were laying around, bored, nothing exciting today. And one of these young men, who was more bored than the others, found himself gazing off towards the gates of the Sultan's palace. And he sees off in the distance that four men carrying a sedan chair are coming along, you know, chair, staves, and it's covered over, you know, silks. Clearly, you know, one of the women of the palace is inside. And so it's got his attention. He's watching it come closer and closer. And till it comes just in front of the gate, and they have to set it down to open the gates. So they set down the sedan chair, and the silks open, and the most beautiful creature steps out. A vision, a young woman like he's never seen. Smooth and radiant, and not like the girls of the souk. The story says her face was like the moon. And he's totally enraptured, but he's just got this glimpse of her. And pretty soon she steps inside the gate and is gone. She's no more than 30 seconds he's seen her. And he's just standing there. Silent. And then he hears raucous laughter behind him. All his friends are watching him, and he realizes his mouth is hanging open, and he's just standing there agape. And they think he's hilarious. They see what's happened. He's totally taken with this woman, and they're laughing at him. And he turns, and he's embarrassed. And then he says, "My God, what I wouldn't give for 2 hours with her." And then they all laugh. And now they're laughing with him. And so he turns to walk away with them. They all walk away arm in arm, hands over shoulders, laughing, and they like his joke. But even as he's laughing with him, he's turning and looking over his shoulder and looking back. Goes out with him that night. They do the usual things. They gamble, they drink, they have a good time. Except he's not having that good a time. He keeps thinking of her. Keeps thinking of her face. So much so that the next day, he makes a different decision. He doesn't do the things he usually does. He goes back to the gates of the palace and waits, hoping to see her again. And he sits and waits and waits and waits, and the gate never opens. Next day, he does the same. Days and days and days, he does the same. And he's wondering, what the hell am I doing? I used to go out with my buddies. We used to have a good time. But he just doesn't seem to have the same taste for it anymore. He can't seem to find enough desire to go out and do those same things anymore. He thinks only of her face. But as the weeks pass, he thinks, I'm really getting nuts. I've got to give this up. Nobody's coming out of this palace. And so finally, says to himself, I don't know what his name is, Ali, get a hold of yourself. Go out, you live your life again. So he kind of picks himself up, he finds his friends again, goes out, figures he's going to, spend some time with the girls of the souk. She does, he pursues, takes them out. He drinks and gambles, though the Quran does not advise any of these things. And has a whole night of partying. And he does it day after day after day for a week, trying to get back into that life. It just does not work. It won't take. So he made a good effort. So, and it not having worked, he defeatedly walks back to the gate to take up his post, looking for her again. Then one day, again, just kind of gazing off in the distance, he sees a sedan chair coming again. She must have come out at some point. Maybe in the week that he went partying, she must have come out, or maybe in the early morning hours while he was asleep. And now he's excited. He knows this is his moment. This is the moment. He's got to tell her that he loves her. He's a young man, he's not aware of the challenges of loving a princess when you're a pauper that just hangs out in the soup with no prospects whatsoever. And also, he's young, and he thinks that his own feelings of love are such that they'll conquer any obstacle. He assumes that his feelings of love will be met because they're so strong. He can't even conceive that she wouldn't care for him the same way. So he's ready to spring, gets ready, comes close to the gate, and as they bring the chair up, four burly guys, and they set it down, and she steps out, and he does something very inadvisable. He leaps forward, puts his hands on her feet, takes the hem of her dress, and kisses it, and says, "Darling, my love, when can we be together?" And she looks down, of course, she's scared to death. But she's a princess, schooled in diplomacy. She looks down, covers herself quickly, and says, looks at him, this young man, dirty and in rags. She says, "In the cemetery." Which is to say, not in this lifetime, buddy. We're not going to be together. She said it beautifully. And then he hears the words, and then these great big guys grab him and launch him. crashes to the ground, and when he recovers himself, dizzy, dirt all around him, she's gone. And he's so excited, he doesn't even feel the pain. He's, oh my God, in the cemetery. He says, oh my beloved, she's smart as well as beautiful. The dead have no eyes. We won't be seen in the cemetery. We can be alone. So he just rushes off. Cemetery's on the outskirts of town. He rushes off, thinking of her. Gets there, goes inside the cemetery, starts to look around. Looking around for the most advantageous place to make love in a cemetery. He's a young man. That's what he thinks. So he just walks around. He walks the perimeter, walks inside. Oh, he's looking for the better spot. Finds one, says, no, it's not good enough. Finds another, spends an hour doing this until he finally decides on, this is the best spot for us. Sits down to wait. And waits. And waits. Waits. Goes on for hours. And then it occurs to him, oh, it may not be so hard for the princess to get out of the palace and under the, you know, watchful eye of her father, the Sultan. She may have to come up with a good excuse. It may take her some time. She may have to wait a while. He thinks, I waited weeks to see her before. I can wait weeks again. She'll come. She's at the cemetery. I'm here. So, settles in. Decides to take walks. But he's cautious about leaving the cemetery. If he leaves the cemetery, he might miss her, you know. When he went on his week-long bender, he missed her coming out of the gates of the palace, so he's not going to leave the cemetery. As much as he'll do is kind of go to the edge of the cemetery and beg a little food from people passing by. And they give it to him. Keeps up his walk. And as he walks around the cemetery, thinking about her and thinking about when she'll come and what they'll do and what it will be like, how beautiful she is, he starts to look at the gravestones. Men and women, old and young. This one died as a child. This one lived to be very old. This one was clearly wealthy. Look at the stone, you know, how beautifully decorated it is. This one was poor. He thinks about these things. And then he notices over time, as the weeks pass, the people that come to the cemetery. And people come and they bury people they love, and he watches them cry. People come to visit the graves themselves, and he listens to what they say. And a man will say, oh, she was so beautiful when she was young. And a woman will come to visit her husband's grave and say, he was such a handsome man. And he looks at them, and many of them are old now and no longer beautiful. And he starts to think, will I still love my princess when she's no longer beautiful? She'll age. She'll no longer look the way she looks today. But these people, they come and they're sincerely mourning the people they've loved, and they continue to love them, and they clearly love them past the time when they were beautiful. Will I still love her? What is it that I love? Why have I fallen in love? What is it I've fallen in love with? And he starts to think, there must be many kinds of beauty, many types of beauty, many reasons to love, deeper reasons than just the surface beauty. And he contemplates this until he finally comes to a question, what is the source of beauty? What is the source of my love? Where does it come from? And he starts to think, it must be God. God must be the source of beauty and the source of this love. And he What is God's beauty like? What is the beauty of God? And he's just a common young man, but he's trying to get into this place of understanding what is God's beauty. And he thinks it must include all the beautiful things of the world. Every kind of beauty he can imagine, that must be all included in God. And he starts to pile all this beauty together in his mind in a great contemplation. Flowers and mountains and rivers and lakes and desert sands and beautiful women and beautiful men, beautiful animals, and it starts to all team together in this gorgeous vision of the totality of all being. And he passes out in bliss. Now, meanwhile, he's been spending a lot of time in the cemetery. I mean, this contemplation has been going on for weeks and months. Now it's somewhere around a year. And at some point, people started to notice there's always this young man in the cemetery. The first day, of course, he was just a beggar, you know, coming to the wall and people giving him some food while he's afraid to leave the cemetery. But as he's always in the cemetery, they begin to think, oh, he's somebody who's trying to do penance for something. He's committed some crime or some sin for which he feels he needs to spend time in the cemetery doing penance. It's a thing people used to do. And thinking that worthy, they started to bring him a little food. But then as the months passed and he never left the cemetery, and then more and more they just found him seated against a, you know, a stone, they began to think he must be a holy man. And he's sitting there, absorbed in this concentration on what is beauty and what is the source of my love. And every once in a while he'd look up and there's food in front of him. People are feeding the holy man. He's grateful, he eats. And it's not long before people start to come to him and ask him questions as a sage. And by this time, he's become a thoughtful person. Thinks a lot. All he has to do is think. He's thinking about love, beauty. And they come to him, and he's genuinely interested. They tell him a problem, and they said, what should we do? He says, I don't know. Let me think about it. And he thinks about it, and he says, come back later. And they come back, and he talks to him about what he's been thinking. Because he has the time to be a thoughtful person now. And sometimes they come with their problems, and they say, will you bless us? Will you bless me? And he thinks, well, of course. And having looked into his own heart and seen a vision of the source of his love and the source of beauty, he gives them a simple blessing. With all of his heart, he wishes, may it be well with you. And that's all he ever says. But the blessings seem to work, and the people keep coming. There's a stream of them that come night and day. And he sits. He tells them what he understands. He tells them that he doesn't understand. They all take it as wisdom. As far as he knows, he's waiting for a girl. And he's struggling with a question. But when somebody comes, he cares about them. He'll say what he can. On the other side of things, on the other side of the gates of the palace, the princess is going on with her life. And she does what princesses do. She's married in a marriage of diplomacy to a prince from another sultanate. And though these things often go badly, it's not so bad for her. She likes him. He likes her. It's a good match. And they have they have that good kind of love that comes from an arranged marriage where they recognize their circumstances and they accept them and they like one another. And that part of their life is good. But she has one real pain, and it's that she cannot conceive a child. And when she doesn't carry it to term. And this is the pain of her life. The years go by, doesn't conceive, whether a miscarriage is. And of course, she has infinite resources, and they brought every doctor, every herbalist, every charlatan, she's seen them. Every wise person, she's taken whatever potion. She's been blessed. She's consulted imams. Nobody knows the answer. Nobody can help her. Finally, one of her maidservants says to her, "My lady, it's not my place to suggest anything. You have infinite resources. You can have whatever you want, and wiser people than me have advised you. But I so care for you, I want you to know what we who live in this city do when we have a problem that we can't figure out, or we have a need that we need prayer about, we need a blessing. There's a sage who sits in the cemetery. And when we have a problem like yours, we go to him. And he offers a blessing, and often that blessing works. And I think maybe at this point you should go see it." And she's so desperate, she says, "Of course, give me your clothes." So they exchange clothes, and the princess has guards take her out in the middle of the night, late at night, dressed as her maidservant. She enters the cemetery, and the guards step back, way into the shadows, and she goes and finds the place where the sage of the cemetery sits. She walks up before him, and she says, "Mola, master." And he hears a voice, and he says, "Princess." And she says, "Oh my God, how can you know me?" He says, "I'm disguised, and you didn't even look at me." He says, "Your voice has been in my ears all these many years. I've never forgotten you." He says, "I'm the young man you said that you would meet in the cemetery." He says, "I'm still here, and I've been thinking about your beauty all of this time. And I'm so grateful to you. My love for you has transformed me. And it's taught me things I never could have imagined, things I never would have thought about before, didn't think about, I hardly thought at all. You made me a contemplative person. And all the many things I've considered now have made my life rich. And though you were far, the vision of you led me to the source of my love for you. I'm forever grateful." He says, "But princess, no one comes to me in joy. They all come in sorrow." He says, "What is your sorrow?" And she tells him the sorrow of her life, that she's married now, and she would love to have a child to complete her life. But she's in pain all the time. She can't have a child. And she's heard that his blessings work and may help. And he says, "Princess, my love," he says, "if there's any merit in anything I've done in my entire lifetime, may it be transformed into a child for you." And that's his blessing, and she goes away. And then he closes his eyes, and he sits back, absorbed again in the source of beauty. In the coming weeks, people notice that he's more still than usual. He doesn't seem to be moving, and the food is piling up. They're also drying out, desiccating. untouched. A few more weeks pass. Someone leans close to him. He doesn't move. Someone puts a hand under his nostrils. There's no air. He's passed on in his bliss. At the same time, the princess is conceived. And she carries the child to term. And she gives birth to a little boy. And when enough time has passed, and it's safe to take her child out of the palace, she's so excited. She wants to take him to see the sage in the cemetery. And she takes him there, only to find that he's died. And there's now a rough marker that's been placed there. And she mourns him genuinely, deeply. And she gives orders that a great sepulchre should be placed there. A monument to the sage of the cemetery. And after a few more years have passed, and when she thinks her child is old enough, she walks into the cemetery and then tells him the story of the love that made his birth possible. Found in a Jewish source, but it's definitely a Sufi story. Mm-hmm. This tradition to which some of us belong, or some of us orient, or some of us are interested in, is oriented around a notion of divine love. Is such story. And we bathe in the love poetry of Hafiz and Rumi. And stories of Layla and Majnun. Khusro and Shireen. Beautiful story, and I wonder, do I believe that? this descent into delving into love in such a way that there's a breakthrough into some divine love. Do we believe that? Do we believe that's possible?
Yes.
Also, what does it mean? There are certainly detachment teachings in Sufism, but Sufism is not really a path about detachment. It's about a path of attachment, deep attachment. Attachment so much so that you can break through into something else. It's not a Buddhist path. It's going the other way, through the other end of things. And I think it would be interesting to talk about what are the practical implications of orienting to love and having love be the factor that catalyzes or opens the heart in such a way that there's a breakthrough to another kind of consciousness. It seems to me it's not a very safe path. Not a path with guarantees, not a graded path to enlightenment, as they say in Buddhism. No, it's a dangerous path. To orient to love is to court destruction in some ways. One of the great Sufi masters, the founder, he's often thought of as the founder of the school of love in Sufism. Sometimes Sufism is divided into the school of knowledge of Ibn al-Arabi and the school of love of Ahmad al-Ghazali. This is the brother of the famous Muhammad al-Ghazali, who was known as a very learned man and who united his Sufi experience with his knowledge as a theologian, and he did great things. He made Sufism acceptable to the greater Muslim world, and thereby preserved it from the radicals or the more conservative elements. His brother was not so even in his approach to things. He was radically oriented to love. And he taught that love as a path in Sufism was a path of successive deaths. A death to the world, a death to the self, and then finally, an experience of the death of the beloved. But I want to hear, what are your thoughts about a story like this? What does it bring up? What do we think about love as a path? How does it work? There's no right or wrong answers. I'm curious what other people think.
It's a path you sometimes don't know you're on.
Meaning that you can be in love without knowing it?
Meaning that love leads you on and you can be blissfully unaware of that fact. Or tortuously unaware of that fact.
Mm-hmm. You have the book, the way I think of it is that it's multi-layer off the level kind of notion. There's the love of emotion. Also, the higher level, you know, sort of the paradigm of synthesis of destruction and building, and all layers in between, from overcoming judgment and things like that. So, it works beautifully.
What do we think of this distinction between secular love and divine love? Is that a real distinction? Is there divine love and then this lesser love?
I think in your story there was a platonic attraction at first, an outer attraction, and that served as a purpose, just like the scent of the rose attracts the pollinator. Mm-hmm. It's a sexual thing in the plant world and in the human world. But you can go beyond that, and then you get into the realness of the inner form of that. And I was focused kind of on the word that you used, destruction, and I felt like there was a continual construction of his love as he moved deeper into the feeling of that, and then was able to transform other people's sorrow through his own groundedness in love. So in a way, it continued to bloom and spread seeds with the more people who came to him.
Yeah. Sufism focuses on a specific kind of love. And it does describe a progression through stages. There are basically two words we use for love from the Arabic. Mahabba, that's love. Love, good love. Love between friends, love of family, even love of your partner. It's the baseline love, loving kindness. The Sufism doesn't focus on that. Sufism emphasizes ishq, passionate love, fiery love. My teacher, Reb Zalman, used to call it horny love. Ishq comes from, has a root word, ashaka, which is a kind of vine that wraps around a tree. It's even said to strangle the tree. And so some Sufis have talked about how the vine of ishq strangles the self until the self dies, and only the fire of that love is left. But the progression is that mahava, base love, is something that grows out of marifa. Marifa, again, is, you know, in some of the discussions I've had in here, it's not head knowledge, it's experiential knowledge. It's known in your body because you've had some experience. And so an experience of a person of one type or another can give birth to mahabbah. Who knows what that recognition is that makes for attraction, or a profound sort of attraction, like this young man has. But it gives birth to mahava, and then mahava gave birth to ishq in him. And these are seen, one is seen as higher than the other. But mahava is higher than gnosis, marifa. And even higher than mahava is ishq, because ishq will burn everything, leaving only itself. You know? Leaving no self. It's hot enough to destroy everything that's not the love itself. Singing something. Going back to Ahmad al-Ghazali and his school of love, he says that the first death that we experience, the first death that happens through ishq, is death of the world. And the death of the world is because the new lovers quickly forget the world itself and its condemnations and its desires and its needs, what they were supposed to be doing when they were making out. The friends that they had before, they will forget them, at least for a little while. Acquaintances, people, everything just drops away for a while. They focus on one another. They're falling in love. And the world falls away. I always like to quote this poem that was in The English Patient, both in the movie and in the novel, where it says, betrayals in war are childlike compared to our betrayals in peace. New lovers are nervous and tender and smash everything.
What?
New lovers are nervous and tender and smash everything. And it's talking about, on the one hand, illicit love, relationships that aren't supposed to happen in the social norms, and then just new lovers in general. They run rampant with each other, and they run over the world, you know. They forget people, they forget to do things, you know. They cause problems because they're so focused on one another. And this is a profound thing. And some people like to point out that The recognition of this kind of love was an advance in our consciousness. And there's almost a certain point in history where it shows up in literature, in such places as Gottfried von Strasberg's Tristan romance, where Tristan and Isolde take a potion, or actually, Tristan is being sent by his uncle to fetch a bride for his uncle from Ireland, Isolde. She's meant for his uncle Mark, King Mark. And he's dutiful. He's sent to get her. And he goes across the channel to Ireland, fetches her, but because it's going to be a political marriage, and Isolde's mother is a witch, and she wants better for her daughter than this, to be married to this older man who she may not be attracted to, she may not love at all, may never be able to love, but they're going to be married. And she doesn't want her life to be awful. So her mother concocts a potion and sends it in a special bottle with Isolde's maid and says, on the night of the wedding, serve them both this wine. And it will make them fall powerfully in love with one another, so that Isolde may be happy with her new husband, and he with her. And, you know, the dashing Tristan, the greatest warrior and great knight of his age, and dutiful to his uncle, has been sent to fetch Isolde. And she hates Tristan. She hates Tristan passionately. Not because he isn't handsome, and not because his manners aren't flawless, and not because he isn't a good man. He's clearly a good man. She hates him because in a battle he killed her uncle. And she feels that she must maintain this hatred. So she doesn't want to have anything to do with him. But he has to fetch her, bring her back on a ship. And on the voyage, they have to figure out how to get along with one another. And let's make a little peace. Let's sit down. We'll have a meal together and talk things over. And maybe we can get over this kind of hatred you have for me. Let's have a little wine. So they go searching for some wine. Oh, here's a pretty bottle. They find it stashed away. Why was it stashed away? They have no idea. They pour from this bottle, and pretty soon they are intoxicated with one another. It's the potion. And the love is so overwhelming, they don't know where the hatred went, they don't know where the enmity went, and they're struggling with this notion of disloyalty, he to his uncle and she to her prospective husband. But they know that they love one another and cannot deny this love for one another. It's killing them. Until finally, they make love. They feel awful about it, and yes, they also feel joy. They were meant to be together, as far as they know. And what wants to be pointed out in a story like this is that, and they have many adventures because of this, we won't go into this, but what wants to be pointed out is that though this is illicit love, love that breaks away from all the social conventions, and social conventions dominated who you would marry, who you would be with, and it was only considered to be family love, arranged marriages, and you'd make the best of it, and you'd have families. And though this is illicit, it was considered a great advance in our consciousness because this love was so unselfish, though it seems very selfish. It's unselfish in that there's not much advantage to it. In that society, there was no advantage to them except having one another. They would lose their stations, they would lose their lives. And they did it anyways. No good to come of it except being with one another. And so it's kind of the ultimate example of forgetting the world. The world be damned, we'll have this. And so he has these famous lines in there, you know, when the maid comes and finds that they're drunk from the bottle, she's horrified. She knew what was in it. She knew what's going to happen now. She knows what their life's going to be. She says, "Oh my God, you've drunk your death. You've drunk your death. You'll be killed by King Mark, both of you." And Tristan says, he says, if by my death you mean this life that I've just come into in this love, then I accept that. This is death. I want it. I want this love. If by my death you mean that King Mark will now kill me and I've betrayed him and I deserve that death, I accept that too. If by my death you mean eternal punishment in the fires of hell for this sin, I gladly accept that too. That's the death of the world. But Al-Ghazali says, that's not where it ends. And Tristan and Isolde find this out too. That next comes the death of the self. When you realize even the things that I want for myself in this relationship with this person that I love, I find that I have to sacrifice them for them. I have to sacrifice my own wants even for them. The person becomes more important to me than the things I want. And this happens in all kinds of ways. In really difficult ways for the relationship. But you make these sacrifices. The example that always comes to me is you settle into a life together. And maybe you know, there's years of just kind of trying to keep your head above water together. You have all these debts, and maybe you've just paid them off. And you're just settling into a place where you can get comfortable again with all these years of struggling together. And then, let's say, my partner comes to me and says, "I'm feeling this need. I think I need to go back to school. I need to give up my career. I've been doing this all these years, it's not right, I need to go back." And within moments your head is spinning. "Oh no, there's $30,000, $40,000. And giving up the income, you know, while she's doing it. Okay, and now I'm going to have to go back to work and get the third job. And all that starts to go through your head and panic floods into you. As she's saying this. And you want to react, but. And you take a breath, and you say, "Well, what do you need from me to do that?" These are the real sacrifices you make in relationship. They're huge, and they're scary. But that's the death of the self. You can't always do it, and you don't do it perfectly. You mess it up. But if you stay in the relationship, you usually get around to these things. And in some ways, it seems like the death of the world that was achieved, you know, in this description of Tristan saying, "And I would give up all of these things. I would give up the whole world for her." That's profound. But in some ways, it's not even as profound as once you have them, and then the things you have to give up inside of that relationship are huge. And they take you to another level of selflessness. And you think that that would be the ultimate thing. And then, Al-Ghazali brings in another level that he calls the death of the beloved. And that is giving up your beloved. So what does he mean by that? How can that be a good thing? And there are different ways to think about this. Rabia al-Adawiyah, she had this famous saying where she says to God, "I've loved you with two loves, one that's worthy of you, one that's unworthy of you. In the unworthy love, I think only of you. In the worthy love, there is only you. So I think only of you, it's still me thinking of you. In the worthy love, there's no me. It is just a you." And in some ways, that's the obliteration of the beloved, the death of the beloved, because the beloved is beloved by someone. There's still an object. And Al-Ghazali goes back and forth saying, in some ways, that's the higher love, because there's so much longing in it. As long as they're opposite you, you're never quite merged with them, and so you're always longing to be more merged and deeper invested in them, to have a closer relationship. And he says, from one perspective, that's deeper, higher, better. And then there's a moment where you have to merge. The merge has to happen, but when the merging happens, you lose yourself. And you don't have them anymore. There's just this. And in some ways, that's a description of a moment of ecstasy in union, whether in a meditation, whether in sexual union, whether, you know, there's a moment of merging where everything dissolves. And this is often used as a description of, you know, dying into divine love, or that's the divine. But I think there's another way to think about this, more on the ground in terms of love and relationships, the way we experience them. Because I really can't go along with this division between secular and sacred love, or divine love as some other category. In fact, I just can't think about it that way at all. It's not that there's a divine love, it's just that love itself is divine. It itself is sacred. And I'm always loving to quote Jesus from, you know, from the Gospel of John, you know, where he says, "Love one another as I have loved you." You know. And he who is not loved has not known God, because God is love. God is love. And I just love this statement. Because, and many of you have heard me say this before, because though no mathematician am I realize that's an equation. God is love. There's two terms on either side of an equal sign. God equals love. And what can you do? You can switch the terms. Love equals God. Through most of life, I don't know from God. I don't know God. Where has God been in my life? Who is this person that I've heard about and read about in texts? What is this persona? I don't know. I've had experiences, yes, but my deepest, my most holy experiences have been with this person and other people through relationship. If I've related to God, I've related to God through this matter, through this heart, this fleshy thing in my chest. Some abstract God, I don't know that God. And so I'd love to switch these terms. Love equals God. Love is divine. And that says something to me. And that says, I don't even have to prove that. I know that in my being, that love feels sacred. Whether it's picking up a newborn child and it feels so precious in my hands that I almost shake and want to give it back because it's too precious to hold. Hold somebody's heart in my hands that's hurting, and you know that thing is sacred and precious. That ache you feel in your heart, you know that's sacred. So I think love is God. And what that means to me is that anytime we experience any of those grades of love or aspects of love, whether it's friendship, where somebody's taken your hand in genuine kindness, or picked you up when you've fallen, or just held a door for you, any of those things is a hierophany, to use, you know, one of these fancy Greek words. That's a divine manifestation in our world. That's a breakthrough of God in the world that I can hold on to, that means something to me. It's a manifestation of divinity, these little aspects of love. And then what can we do in the world except gather more and more of them up and grant others more and more of them? And in some ways, filling out the world with divinity by spreading love in action with one another. So, taking that perspective and thinking about the death of the beloved, as we experience that on the ground in our life and relationships, that happens too. You know, you can give up yourself for the other, but there comes a point in some relationships where you have to give up the beloved because the relationship itself doesn't work. You know? It won't happen. You love them. You adore them. You love them painfully. And it doesn't work. And then you can make this choice. It's like saying, oh, I hate them. They were so mean to me. You know, the relationship didn't work. It was awful. And kind of shut yourself off from the love that you felt. Or you can make the distinction that the love was not the relationship. You know? The relationship was the things you hoped for and you wanted and you tried to have. But the love was born before that. Born in the middle of it and has its own existence. It doesn't have to die if the relationship doesn't work. And it comes back to you like a question. Will I love them whether they're nice to me or not? Will I love them whether this works out or not? And if you can say yes to that, then you've entered another zone of love that is beyond the beloved. Beyond having to have the object of your love. You've grown into an expanded feeling of love. And that's also necessary in relationships. Even if they continue to work but they have problems, that's what's happening, the death of the beloved. For a moment,